This program is brought to you by Jewel, sous vide by Chef Steps. Jewel takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. So I'm going to do something a little different today. Usually I have a whole spiel planned for my guests, and I list awards and accolades, and our guest today definitely has those things and is a well-known chef in the food world. But I'm going to let our guest Tunde Wei explain his work and what he does. Tunde, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's fantastic. Why are you laughing? explain my work and myself.
When people ask you what you do, what do you say?
So I say I'm a cook and a writer. But before all that, I'm a Nigerian. I'm an immigrant. And I think those are some like relevant labels because they affect most of what I do, except when I'm sleeping. But yeah, so I use food and my writing to sort of interrogate normativity or the orthodoxy in different spaces. So I have been and I am, you know, just critical of ideology that is dominant in whatever space. So if it's like, you know, progressive or movement thinking in that space, you know, I think my work is to use food to help put a light on the inconsistencies in those spaces. And similarly, of course, you know, the bigger threat, I think, is the more conservative neoliberal ideologies. And so also using food to show the massive inconsistencies there too. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. So that all of those things kind of come together in these events that are really distinctive. So you kind of use dining in this kind of subversive way. So you've done things like we were first introduced via an article that I was writing about a pop-up counter that you were doing in New Orleans.
Thank you very much for writing that, by the way.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. Yeah. And can you explain this pop-up lunch counter that you did?
Absolutely. So the name of the stall was S-A-A-R-T-J. And it was a space where I was interrogating racial wealth disparity. It was in New Orleans. And what I did was, for a month, I served a single dish for lunch, and it was regularly priced at $12. And after going through a series of conversations and interactions with the customer, I asked folks who self-identified as white if they wanted to pay 2.5 times more, $30, which represents the racial income gap in New Orleans. So between white and black folks specifically. And so the stall using food was a way to sort of like show the true cost of say food, but the true cost in general and the cost burden of things for folks of color in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you recently did a pop-up in Nashville called Hot Chicken Shit.
Which you did not write about.
I didn't. I wanted to. I tried. We'll talk about that off air. Okay. The conversations I had about writing about that. But Hot Chicken Shit was tackling gentrification, specifically the displacement of black Is it Nashvillians?
Yeah, Nashvillians. Yeah.
Nashvillians is it? Yeah. But you know, black residents from the city, you know, due to gentrification.
Yeah. So Nashville is an interesting place. I had never been there before. I knew it existed, of course, but it wasn't. It's not this place that comes to people's minds as a cosmopolitan city. It is Nashville, and I'm saying this because this is true for me to the extent of my knowledge of the world right now, is gentrifying in an anecdotal sense, but also in a statistical sense, right? In different places and communities, people talk about gentrification. And I believe that what you perceive is also real, right? So there's a perception of gentrification, but there's also the reality of gentrification. In Nashville, those two things actually like coincide. Mm. And you can see why people are just everywhere, just overrunning the place, crawling out of sewers and jumping off rafters. They're everywhere, white people everywhere.
Oh, white people.
White people.
Are
they're
you
everywhere.
Talking about everybody?
Or? Yeah, no, white people.
Okay.
Just like a plethora. But then you can also, there are also statistics that show that the city is changing considerably. And we know because of, you know, the history of cities in America, that when resources left, folks of color were made to stay in a sense. And now that the sort of the trend or the fashion has changed and city living is more in style. Now, folks of color are being forced, black folks, to be specific, are being forced to move out. So, in Nashville, the work that I was trying to do was two things. And the first thing was I identified a census block group in North Nashville, which is a historically black community. And a census block group is the smallest statistical unit of measurement that the government collects information on folks for, the census. And this census block group is black, working class, and facing gentrification pressures. It's actually census tract 142, census block group 1, to be specific. And this community, this area has about 300 properties. And we wanted to purchase all the potentially rentable units in properties in that area. Because what was happening is that people were moving in and one of two things would happen, right? They would either buy a property that would say a duplex or a triplex, renovate it, and then take the prices up, and which will force the tenants to move out because of the increased rent, or they would bring the property down and build what they call tall and skinnies in Nashville. So they'll put like these two modern-looking buildings on one lot, and then those properties go for $500,000.
Hmm.
So I wanted to move the inventory of out of market rate housing, out of the market, and move that to a community land trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying a lot, but back to hot chicken. I was gonna sell hot chicken for exorbitant sums, and the money that we got from the sale of the hot chicken, we're gonna use to purchase these properties that we will then transfer to a community land trust, which does work to keep properties permanently affordable by deed restricting the properties, and also through income requirements, having folks who make a certain amount live in that community. So it preserves the integrity of the community. Yeah, that's the project.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really fascinating, and it really makes people confront these really uncomfortable things. And I think in food media, we like to have this like narrative of like food brings us together,
yeah,
and warm, fuzzy feelings, and we're all like sitting around the dinner table. And the pop-ups that you host like really confront that and say, you know, well, who is sitting at this table,
yeah,
who historically has been invited to sit here?
Exactly.
Like, and how do we make it more? We've had a talk about the word equitable.
Yeah. What did I say about it the last time when we had? Yeah.
Oh, you were saying that No, it wasn't equitable. It was
is it reparations?
Reparations. Yes. Ooh, yeah. We should talk about that.
We had a thing. Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
In particular with the New Orleans story with the lunch counter.
Yeah.
When I was writing the piece, you know, people were saying, oh, is it reparations? And I was really uncomfortable with that because reparations, it just didn't feel right. And then you and I had a conversation about that word in particular, especially mm-hmm. like pertaining to your project and like,
yeah,
the idea that like, that white people have to like give black people things mm-hmm. is really, it's really destructive.
Yeah, of course, because it doesn't belong to them in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. I don't remember the context of that particular conversation around reparations, but I remember that what had happened, and I don't know if I can say this.
You can say whatever you want on the show.
You can edit it later.
It'll just all go out.
Okay, well, I don't know, the person who was editing your writing was a white person, mm-hmm. and they had used that word, and I hadn't used that word. And then you were, and I think they had maybe tweaked your language to include that, and you were uncomfortable with
that.
I
hadn't used the word reparations at all, and they added it in.
Yes.
And I pushed back against that.
Yes.
Because I didn't use that word, you didn't use that word. And, you know, a white editor adding that word as there's layers of
exactly. And I remember we talked, yes, exactly. So we talked, and that was the thing. So interestingly enough, when I did the Nashville Hot Chicken Shit project, I started off from a place of reparations. That was what I started off with, like, or rather I would say reparative justice. Mm-hmm. And we raised through our sale of hot chicken, we raised $102,000. Mm. One lady gave $100,000.
Wow.
And a white lady. And we had had a conversation. And in that conversation, I expressed this idea of reparations. Because part of what was happening was, like I said, you're going to give this money and you're not going to be at all involved in what happens. But then, you know, I also want to say that I realized in saying that you then build a relationship with somebody who's giving $100,000, and who isn't asking any questions. But then I feel like, oh, I think I should maybe tell you exactly what's happening, but that's a separate thing. But because I started with this idea of reparations, and because also to the project, the project was part of a group public art show, mm-hmm. and it was funded by the city. And so they gave me, I can say this, they paid me $10,000, to work over 3 months. And that included a bunch of things, but that was the money that I got. And I felt like, okay, I need to do something with this, like pay my bills and shit. But I also need to like sort of leverage this money to do more. And because of the affiliation with the city, the city's art departments or art council, I also had access to other people in the city who were making decisions around issues. And so I remember I approached the gentleman who runs the city of Nashville's economic development office. Like, he oversees the distribution or the allocation of billions of dollars, or at least manages what that looks like, investments coming in and payments going out. So he's pretty important in the city. And my approach of reparations, while I didn't use that word, was manifest in how I came at him. I'm like, yo, you all need to give up some money. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no.
Right. Like, of course, like, no.
And like, what happens is, they all these formulas, right? Like, how much it costs to build a building, how much taxes the city is going to get from building this building, what is the potential tax revenue when this building is built, and then this spurs development elsewhere. If we do like tax increment financing, which is delaying our revenue so that we can get more, so we use tax money to finance development projects so that we can make more money. So there are all these fucking things happening, and then somebody walks in and says, you know, give me money, right? And then so I had to I had to be tactical and say, all right, let's talk about financing. If we raise money by selling hot chicken, how can we leverage the money that we raise through these hot chicken sales to purchase property? Because the truth of the reality that I saw is that everybody thinks gentrification is a problem, but most of everybody is stuck in a paradigm that says the only way out of this problem is through the same prism that got us there, which is this like economic framework that is interested in highest and best use of property of people. And you cannot make an economic argument that makes sense in favor of giving people affordable housing. It just doesn't happen. And that's why we have a deficit of affordable housing. We have a deficit of market rate housing in areas that are so-called desirable. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Oh, no, don't be sorry. That's that kind of brings me to one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is that I think so many chefs are like, I'm going to host a pop-up or dinner series, and it's kind of focused about them and their expressions of, you know, whatever cuisine they cook or, you know, don't cook or whatever, and using restaurant spaces in that way to kind of express themselves. But I see your work as, you know, an exploration of the way things are right now and how we got here. Someone asked me if your work was more kind of, you know, closely tied to the art space or to the dining space.
I have
my thoughts, but what do you
think? Who is cutting the check? So it depends, right? Like, so I have been and I am in group shows. Like the work in, so interesting. Like the work in Nashville was like artwork. It was public art, like technically. I was paid by the Art Commission of Nashville. And I remember a friend of mine who was like hanging out and writing about my work said that, oh, this is different from what you're doing. This is like community organizing, right? Because we had these meetings in the community. I was talking to folks from the community, and they were saying like really hard and important things that are not sexy. They're talking about like, yo, you know, development is happening. I've been in my home for 50 years and my tax liability just went up. That's not sexy. And he says, like, I feel like, you know, the work that you do around race and immigration is conceptual and it's like sexy or whatever. But that's strange because like that was an art project, right? And I'm part of another group show in Pittsburgh. I'm doing a project about, basically I'm doing a dinner series to facilitate love marriages between U.S. citizens and immigrants by hosting first dates that are blind dates. So that's also an opportunity, but there is this like outcome, which is a love marriage, that I have in mind. So I don't know. It's just, it depends on who's paying.
So you're okay. Check. You're basically hosting blind dates and you're cooking for these blind dates and hoping that they get married.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, isn't that how it works? People have a date and then they eventually get married.
Yeah.
But we're stating from the outset, like, we hope you get married.
From the outset. Yeah. Just, you know, we enjoy your meal and I hope this ends in marriage.
Exactly. I mean, and this happens on Match.com. It happens on Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire, Bachelor, Bachelorette. I mean, it's the sort of the digitization of love and relationships. It's like quicker. And so why not do that before the new Congress is sworn in?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So one of the first places that I came across your work was Detroit Paper. And it was an essay that you'd written, and you owned a restaurant in Detroit.
I did.
Yeah. And you were talking about kind of your what your the impetus for doing so and kind of what you learned about yourself in the city. Can you talk about that piece?
Which piece is this? Is it the piece in City Lab?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So I wrote it. I think it was published last year. And right, is that? It's called Whitewashing of a Food Scene. And I basically talk about how Detroit is a predominantly black city and popular food as celebrated by media, awards, investment, capital is white. And that's crazy to me. And then I also sort of like chart my complicity in that I opened up a restaurant with a friend and we were serving predominantly white people what I would classify white food, which is sort of like modern new American food. And I didn't have sort of like any sort of like critical race consciousness at the time. I had some consciousness, but I talk about having this restaurant and then wanting to expand and then sort of like going to the offices of Bedrock. So Bedrock is a company that is owned by Quicken Loans, and Quicken Loans is owned by Dan Gilbert, who is a billionaire who owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, who has his headquarters in Detroit, and he moved his headquarters from the suburbs of Detroit into the city. And that like spurred what we are now seeing. I think that was a huge inflection point. He poured in billions of dollars into the downtown area, buying up skyscrapers, bringing in his employees from the suburbs into the city. This was in concert too with the other anchor institutions in the city, the universities, the nonprofits. It was a coordinated thing, you know, to repopulate the city that was losing folks. And I went in there because we wanted to move from where we were or have a second location in the downtown area. And he walked into this office and the real estate development or the real estate director of the company showed us this model of the city. And I'm looking at it and it is Detroit, it's downtown Detroit. And he's just like pointing at things. He's like, we own this, we own that, we own this, we own the master lease to this, to that. And I was like, fuck, you own everything, right? Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I remember thinking like, oh shit, that we... myself in that restaurant thought that we were doing something different and subversive, that we had this like little cool quirky restaurant and that this was the alternate reality that we were creating. But like this man with billions of dollars has the might and has so like the will and the capital to exert his idea of what the city should be on everybody, and that the war that was being waged wasn't even really a war. That if my restaurant represented a certain sort of like, you know, DIY, like hipster response to more corporate America, that in fact those two things were symbiotic, and that my restaurant and myself and people like me, young, mostly white people who were part of this downtown Detroit community that was very active and engaged in, the so-called revitalization of Detroit, and that was also progressive. That they were just, in fact, laying the groundwork for what will be this new hyper-capitalist Detroit. And this is true everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. The sort of like first wave of folks who gentrify, and not even to say that I was part of a first wave, but any wave is part of a larger ocean. And there's a larger ocean of consumption, of whiteness, of capital. But the problem that was real and never admitted was that not only were we complicit, we were actually like tilling the soil, mm-hmm. fertilizing it in service of this larger, distinctly undemocratic process where one person decides because they have capital what the city would look like. And people will disagree. In fact, I know people, somebody this one gentleman who was like a top executive at a car company in Detroit, who I was friends with, you know, who owned a restaurant and who was white, disagreed with me. And I could tell that I was right, because all the people who had come to Detroit like around the same time that I had done, and who were trying to do these small DIY things, eventually, some of them eventually ended up working for this gentleman, this Dan Gilbert fella. So I could see the acute connection that was.
Yeah. I think it's so fascinating that from there you moved into this role of, like, you know, using discomfort to confront people with, you know, these, like you said, those waves of it's basically just like pushing people of color out of places.
And that's what it is.
And I can't believe we haven't used the word capitalism yet. Yeah. But that's basically what it is.
The thing that fucks you up is that it's good people that are doing this, right? Good people. People who say they're good. Like, I just, you know, I'm just trying to get a good deal on a home. I'm just trying to, you know, be in a community of people that I relate to. And I don't know. I would be honest and say it's hard for me in those sort of like interpersonal interactions to fault people. You know, I'm like, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I disagree with you, but I understand what you're saying. And I don't have the energy to disagree with everybody who I think is wrong all the time. It's just like exhausting. And especially when the reality is so pervasive, you know, it's inescapable. That this is the normal way of doing things. And so my only sort of, the only outlet that I have that creates some safety and doesn't like engender insanity for me is through my dinners. Is that I can be blunt and forceful and say, like, this shit is fucked up, but I don't have to say it to every white friend that I have or every black person who's a friend of mine who also thinks in this sort of like corrupted sort of way. Like, I can just like fuck it. I can be chill. We can just talk about fucking soccer, or we can talk about some other shit. I don't have to like be on the prowl every single day. But in my work, I can. In my writing, I can write about it. Mm-hmm. In my dinners, I can do the same thing. In my the talks that I give publicly, I can do the same thing. On interviews, I can do that too. But it's stressful in all these places as well. It's even more stressful to try and tell, you know, using this specific example, a white person, that you're pushing black folks out, you know, and even have them admit it, but then throw their hands up like, well, what can I do? You know, well, you can leave, but, you know, nobody wants to. Yeah. You can do that. You can get the fuck out.
That's awesome. Get out. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Tunde Wei.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. I use Jewel to help me host the most delicious dinner parties. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is super intuitive and has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for prepping many perfect portions, making it easy to cook for a crowd, and it's hands-free so you can focus on entertaining while Jewel does the work. And pro tip, Jewel is also great for travel. I throw mine in my suitcase if I'm headed to a rental house with any kind of uncertain kitchen. From perfect steak to juicy, tender Thanksgiving turkey, Jewel makes the best food you've ever tasted. Just be sure to save some room for mini jars of pumpkin pie. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/joule, code HRN.
All right, so we are back with chef, author. What else do you want on there?
Just a kid from the block.
Oh my God. Okay. <I'm just kidding>. We're back with Tunde Wei. So this is the part of the show where we get like a little more personal. I know you are a proud Nigerian from, I'm going to say it wrong.
Yeah.
Lagos.
Lagos.
I always try to pronounce it right, and I always fuck it up.
Well, it's Portuguese, so I'm sure Lagos is maybe how it's pronounced in Portugal. But it's Lagos, where we're from.
Lagos.
Yeah.
Lagos. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll get that right. What do you remember about like dining there? And how often do you go back?
I haven't been back in 18 years because of my immigration status. So I lost my status when I ended my schooling, which is why I came here, and I haven't been back, and so I've been sort of undocumented until I was documented for maybe my first 5 to 8 years in America. I don't know how long, maybe 5 years, and then undocumented since then until maybe like June of this year when I got like my first documentation, which is like a work permit. So I'm now tenuously documented. I don't have like an official status, but I'm applying for a green card. So yeah. But the question was when I haven't been back in 18 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you remember about dining there?
My family didn't dine out. There was no like dining out culture. We did go to like Chinese restaurants. Maybe like a couple of times, like once a year or something, go to this Chinese restaurant at a hotel close to our house. I remember like one time my mom like tipping. I was like fucking 5 years old, and she left money on the table. And I'm like, what's happening? She's like, it's for the gentleman. I'm like, how is he going to know? I was just like, because I wasn't used to any of this. But then we would also, dining would be like, there would be a roadside kiosk that would be selling roasted meats called suya. Mm-hmm. So we'll get that, you know, or, excuse me, sometimes my parents would go to this, like, joint, like a restaurant, but not a restaurant at all. Like somebody had like was making some food in their home, and they would get these like specialty dishes, like isiewu, which is goat head stew, which came from the southern part of Nigeria, and we lived in the southern eastern part of Nigeria, and we lived in a different community altogether. We lived in the west, western Nigeria. So it was like a delicacy. So we would get that. So dining out was that. Or dining out was like when my mother's relatives were coming from where she lived, again, in another part of the country, and they would bring these like soups that were intricate and like only a couple of people could make it really well. And they would bring like smoked game from, so that was what our experience was. Most of our experience was like either eating at home or eating at other people's homes during parties. Yeah.
Wow. So Yemi, who has been, Yemi Amu, who's amazing and has been on this show before.
Yemi. Yes.
Yes, she also grew up in Nigeria and remembers, she talked about Chinese food restaurants a lot and how different the Chinese food is in Nigeria, you know, compared to here.
Yeah, I was so young. I don't remember, like, I remember, like, the hot chili sauce and the spring rolls. But I don't remember. You know, the other thing, too, we'd go to bakeries. There was a Filipino bakery, I think it was Filipino-owned, called Big Treat. And they had, like, all sorts of fucking baked goods. They were amazing. We would do that, and then maybe once in a while we'll go to like a pizza shop, but it was irregular. Yeah.
So when you came to America, where did you come first? Where did
Detroit.
You stay? Detroit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I moved to Detroit. My mother's sister lived in Detroit, so when we came, my brothers and I, we lived with her. Yeah.
Do you remember like your first experiences with American food? I'm making air quotes because, you know, whatever.
I do, actually. Means. I do. And I'm not sure if this is real, if I'm making it up, but I think it's so true that when I came that night, I remember it happening, but I asked my cousin, who is like, he's probably like 5 years older than me. So when I was 16, he was like maybe 19 or 18 or 20, if he could take me to McDonald's. Because I'd had burgers before. Like Nigeria had like burgers that were super expensive and people made burgers. But I grew up watching a lot of British and American television.
Like what?
Like Ninja Turtles. There was a specific block of shows called the DJ Cat show. It was just like furry puppet that would introduce cartoons. And it's like DJ Cat. Ba-na-na-na-na.
DJ Cat.
Yeah. And it was like Ninja Turtles, Silver Birds. Yeah, Brave Song, just all these like random cartoons. But like the commercials would show two things that I remember, cereal, toys, and fast food. And the burgers look so fucking, impressive and like plump and just shiny. And so I wanted to try a McDonald's burger and see if it was different from what I had had. And I was like, wow, it's not plump. The bun is, it's fucking squished and the meat is not as glistening.
Did you like the fries though?
I don't remember the fries, so probably not. Yeah,
probably not. Yeah. Wow, that's a story.
But best fries, fast food, Rally's. Do you know Rally's?
Yes, Rally's, and also known as Checkers.
Yes.
Where I grew up in Maryland, there was a Checkers.
It was a Checkers, and then it was transitioning, and it was also a Rally's in Detroit. So yeah, they have the best.
They have the best fries. I agree.
Yeah.
You can also get them as chili cheese fries.
I don't do that. That's
just cheese fries. Uh-huh. That's it. I thought there was more.
Yeah, no. But then I worked at Wendy's for a year when I was 19 years old. And the best combination is hot fries from Wendy's with salt in a Frosty. So you get the fries that are salty.
I've seen this.
This is amazing. Right?
Listen, just
hold on a second. Is salty, right, on the outside, but then you know how fries are like hard and crunchy on the outside, but then soft on the inside, and so that's the textural component. Then you dip it into the cold, sweet ice cream, or frosty thick, and you like chocolate, and you bite it, and then you lose your job because you're not supposed to eat on that work,
and then you get fired.
That was what happened. So, yeah. Anyway.
So I always ask my guests if you can talk about one of the worst restaurant experiences you've ever had.
Worst restaurant experiences. I can't think of anything. Maybe in response to that, I want to say that I've been saying this for a time, and I finally heard somebody else say this in describing their restaurant experience, is that I go to so many restaurants because I travel a lot for work. And I eat good food that is delicious. But like food has to be more than delicious. You know, like you can't just come to me with some good food. I expect that, you know, like you can't be a nice person and expect to get, or you can't be a decent person or not be a dick and expect that because you're not being a dick, you should get
be rewarded.
Exactly. And I feel like that's where restaurants are. It's like we serve good food. And everybody serves good, like most people, like if you're going to pay money, like you're going to get good food. And I don't think like that's enough. I think that there has to be other things that you're doing. You have to be doing. So my worst restaurant experience is really just the realization that there are so many restaurants that are mediocre because all they're worried about is like serving good food. And they don't know that their food is good, but it's not better than everything else that is out there. It's just the same, you know? Yeah.
So I also ask guests, you know, what they kind of make of today's dining culture, wherever they work or live or, you know. I think with you, what's interesting is that you cook and you're a chef, and but you also write.
Yeah.
So you kind of are like a part of the dining culture, but you're also talking about it.
Yeah.
What do you make of today's dining scene?
I think there isn't enough competition in the sense that we only have one kind of restaurant. Most restaurants are concerned with feeding people or with providing a dining experience. There isn't like another genre of restaurants, say, in the vein of my dinners, in the vein of what, say, like the People's Kitchen Collective are doing, or this fellow in Philadelphia, Kurt Evans, with his end mass incarceration dinners. Like all these dinners that are focused on social issues or focused on serving a morality apart from just the story of how the ingredients got on the plate. And that it's, yeah, we need restaurants as spaces for escape because we need some respite from the situations that we live in, but these restaurants also embody the same sort of systems that are causing the stress that we're trying to escape from. And so if every restaurant is that restaurant, then we're never going to get to where we need to go. So we need restaurants that are different, that create some sort of confrontation with this reality, to challenge for mind share, for customers, for change. These standard restaurants that just serve food. So there isn't enough variety. There actually isn't enough variety in the current slate of restaurants that are doing the sort of food that is celebrated by popular food culture.
Yes. So you said a bunch of stuff that I want to like tease out.
Yeah.
So first, Kurt Mass.
Kurt Evans. Yeah.
His dinners in Philadelphia, I haven't heard of them. What are they?
So he has these dinners called the EMI dinners, End Mass Incarceration. And dude is super cool. I met him when I did a dinner in Philly, and he's a chef in Philly. But he's a black dude, and he has his dinners where folks come together and they talk about mass incarceration. He has, I think, I haven't been to the dinners, but I know about them, but he has experts on the subject talk about it. And I want to say portions of sales go to a bail fund.
Hmm.
But from a culinary perspective, one of the things that he does is he makes, in some courses, like jail food. So he made something with Cheetos and some other shit that apparently people eat in detention or in jail. And he served it. And so I thought that was super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. But I'm not talking about it, like, you know, because there is a cynical way to approach this, like a cynical and opportunistic way to do this. Or like, let's talk about shit because this is the shit that is trending right now.
Yeah.
But there's a real way to do this. You know, if you affect it personally or if you study deeply,
mm-hmm.
And if you're doing the work to not just in these public spaces but also in private spaces to examine your role and how you can help to end these oppressive structures that you are cooking about, then to me that's valid. So so his work is interesting. I mean, Ben and Christina South Philly Barbacoa,
mm-hmm.
in Philadelphia also.
Which, congrats on that chef's table episode you were a part of.
Yeah,
it was great.
It was a brief cameo. I don't have to congratulate you. I was just there for like 2 minutes. It's funny because people were texting me like, congratulations, why didn't you tell me? I'm like, what do I look like texting you and saying like, I'm on chef's table.
Yeah,
it's not
and
mine.
The episode is not
yeah,
about
it's
you.
Not like, I was there for like 26 seconds, you know, like anyway. But so they are doing that sort of work as well. I just like there are a bunch of people. I'm sure there are people here in New York City as well who are doing. There's a lady, Kim Chow. Do you know her?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Food Book Fair is also an HRN show.
Yeah. So she, you know, it's part of Allied Media Conference, and they had this super conceptual restaurant called the Dream Cafe, where mm-hmm. they sort of like imagined the future that was equitable. And so like
and all in of, Detroit.
Yes, exactly. In Detroit. And they took over a restaurant there for a week. And so these are the things that I'm talking about. We need such a, we need this sort of vibrancy that competes with this sort of escapist food experience that we are all investing in currently.
Yeah, so you also said that, you know, the ways in which I don't think we realize that, like, restaurants can participate in these oppressive structures. Like, I talk about it a little bit in my writing, but I do still encounter people who are like, you know, how, like, you know, restaurants are where we all, you can go and buy food. And it's like, well, yeah, that would be great if it were true.
Yeah.
But restaurants are just as susceptible to the oppressive structures of anywhere else in the country.
I mean, this place that we're staying in, what's this place called?
Roberta's.
Roberta's, yeah. Like, isn't like, so people may argue with this, but this is sort of an anecdotal theory, if you will, right? So maybe 15, 20 years ago, the sort of like anchor development that that shaped commercial development mm-hmm. in cities, the sort of anchor tenant that shaped development in cities was retail, right? So you'd go to a strip and you'd see a bunch of boutiques. And that was how like commercial development was attractive to a certain kind of consumer. You know, you have these boutiques and folks can come to and purchase clothing and accessories, and they're like, oh, this is a cool neighborhood. And then they buy property, and then that property sort of like gets the values go up and people get pushed out. Today, you know, restaurants are that, you know, restaurants and bars. Any city that is trying to develop in a certain sort of way, you know, to target a certain kind of consumer, is looking for an entertainment district that is almost exclusively restaurant, bar, and then maybe a space for shows.
Mm-hmm.
And
so or a coffee shop.
Exactly. Yep. So food spaces, grocery stores, especially food spaces have become like a tool of gentrification. They are actually at the vanguard that even before, you know, more traditional development moves in, this sort of first wave of demographic change happens when, you know, a cool trendy restaurant opens up in a desolate or so-called desolate community and it attracts a certain kind of person. You know, before it was the artists and the galleries, and then before then after that it was the boutiques, and now it's restaurants. So restaurants do this. So as a physical space in the built environment, restaurants are a tool for exploitation. Mm. But then in the restaurant space, when you look at the hierarchy of, exactly, you're like touching, yeah.
The no, skin. I had an itch.
Oh, I thought you were like indicating your skin color, which is black. Yeah, it's like black in the back.
I was scratching my hand.
But yeah, you also were signaling the truth.
But yes, I am also black.
That is, you're a black woman. And when you go to restaurants, the folks who are usually in the back of the house, black and brown folks, the folks who are in the front of the house, are white folks. And what that means is, if folks don't know, I'm sure folks know, but like if you're in front of the house, you make more money than the back of the house. Mm-hmm. But in the back of the house, there's prestige there, right? If you're a chef or if you're whatever. But if you're a person of color, you don't get to be executive chef. You don't get to, you know, have your creation or have what is on the menu attributed to you. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways that restaurants sort of facilitate the continued disenfranchisement of people of color, of working class folks, and we, I think not confronting these systems in restaurants is a disservice, right? Like finding restaurant spaces as a place or contriving of restaurant spaces as a place of escape is problematic because the systems that we're escaping from exist there and then they're reinforced there. And then they're also, you know, upheld there. And so we have to introduce and disrupt, we have to introduce the anecdote in those spaces by disrupting the sort of like complacency and placidness that is in those spaces because people don't want to think beyond what's on the plate.
Right.
Yeah.
So quick story is that, you know, speaking about Roberta's in particular, my husband and I, we weren't married yet, but we came here on like a day trip from Boston. And this was 7 years ago. And we had heard that Roberta's was a really good restaurant. So we assumed it was like fine dining. And he was in like a full suit. And I was in like a nice dress.
He was showing
and
out.
And heels and earrings.
I love it.
Hair up, you know. And then we walked in and I swear to God, like the record stopped. Everyone was like, they're not from here. But before we got into the building, the cab driver, because we were staying in Manhattan, he was driving. He was like, are you sure there's a restaurant around here? Like, it looks, you know, doesn't look safe.
What?
None of this stuff was here yet. Or there was like one or two places. It wasn't like this, you know.
Bustling.
Yeah.
Center of empire.
It wasn't yet. And you see the power of restaurant spaces.
Exactly.
In like in economic terms. It just completely changed this like, you know, 5-block radius.
There's also, when I went to Nashville, an interesting thing happened for me personally is that I observed folks who were being subversive about how space could be used. So I went to this restaurant called Slim and Huskies. And it's a thing in Nashville. It's owned by 4 black dudes. And these black dudes aren't like black trying to assimilate. They are black and who they are. You know, big beards, they're big gentlemen, you know. And they're cool, super cool people. You walk in there, and then just walking in there, because, you know, spaces have an aesthetic and, you know, that we can identify, like, racially, if you know what I mean. Like, you walk in the place, like, oh, it's a black joint, it's a white joint. This space, you would think that it was a, maybe it had, like, subway tiles. It had, like, these, like, interesting fixtures. It had sort of these, like, tables that were wood. And so you'd be like, oh, this is like a white-owned joint, you know, subconsciously or whatever. But then you walk in and they're fucking playing 702 R&B music. They're playing Jagged Edge. And then everybody, I swear to Jesus Christ, everybody who's working there is black. And then I walk in there and I'm like, they have my fucking favorite beer. They have like a Belgian triple that you don't even find like anywhere. Like, and they have that shit there and they're serving their, you know, their pies, you know, the pizza, and it's black folks doing it, and there's a vernacular that is particular to African Americans that is present there. But then this, and then I was in line, I was seeing this young woman, she's just like fucking like dancing and like in line waiting for her pizza. But it's like a multicultural space. The white people there too, they're all kinds of people, like all the young people. And the dudes who run it, I became kind of friends with. And one of the guys, Mo, and I was talking, I'm like, yo, like, was this like purposeful? Like, did you know? It's like, he's like, yeah. And we knew exactly what we were doing. We're trying to create a space that would like, and I'm using my words now to approximate what he said, that couldn't be easily identified, but that was welcoming, but that was still black, but everybody was there, you know? And I think that, and then that community now is gentrifying, you know?
Mm. Like around them, kind of.
Exactly. Yeah. But then they are also expanding, you know, they're also getting other places and they, you know, they are attempting to hire from within and like grow the company. I mean, these are young men like me, they're my age, like in their 30s, 4 dudes who had a business, they sold the business, they didn't get any equity or loans. They opened up their first restaurant, second restaurant. They didn't take out any loans. They have like 5 locations successful, like 4 in Nashville. I think they opened 1 in Memphis. They're looking at other places around the South to open up. And I just think, you know, that sort of reality can exist. You know, that in a community that is black, you can have like black businesses that can be successful if they're given a chance. Now, those guys are rare for for many reasons. Like, they get a bunch of shit, mm-hmm. you know. But the reason why they are rare is because of the overwhelming encroachment of sort of like businesses that aren't critical in how they operate, like food businesses.
Yeah.
And then aid or even assist gentrification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I've been like nodding my head furiously as we've been talking. So my last question for you, which I ask everyone, is if you could have your last meal in a restaurant space, where would it be and who is invited?
Who's invited? Shit.
And you can invite anyone from history, dead or alive, celebrities, I don't know, anyone you want.
All right. So I would say I was in Detroit and my cousin got married and it was like a family affair. Friends, family, people I hadn't seen in like 20 years. I was like with Nigerians all through. I would say like my favorite restaurant would be, I have this one dim sum restaurant that I really like in Detroit. It's called Shangri-La. They have chicken feet. That's delicious. Baked pork dim sum. So I would do that. I'll definitely do those. I'll do like the, they also have like a squid and they also have a tripe dim sum dish. I'll do those. I'll do like the custard buns, delicious. I'll get down with those. And I'll just have like...
You would have dim sum.
Yeah, I'll have dim sum. And I would have like my homies with me, like the kids that I grew up with, Nigerians. Yeah, and they also have Final Absolution, which is a Belgian triple.
Final Absolution?
Yeah, Final Absolution.
I don't even think I've seen that.
It's made in, it's a Detroit brewery, and it's Dragon Mead is the brewery, and Final Absolution is that particular label that is a triple. They have that there with the dim sum, and so it's my favorite place.
Is that the only thing you'd be drinking, or would you that want other stuff?
I think I would drink that, and if anything else, I'll add some like rum. Or whiskey.
What kind of rum?
Zacapa.
Okay, yeah. Zacapa. I wasn't expecting that. That's a rare one.
Yeah. I'm cultured. What can I say?
No, I'm a rum fan too. That's a rare one. Yeah.
Do you know Therese Nelson?
Yes. Okay. I'm like her biggest fan.
She is
She's been on the show too.
She turned me on to that. Like after I did the pop-up, the Sauté thing. Oh my God, I said it. But anyway, after I did the pop-up in New Orleans, she sent me this note and she said, congratulations on an amazing Black History Month. And then she sent me that rum.
Wow.
That rum has changed my life because like, I prefer rum not to whiskey, which is my favorite drink. And if I'm drinking... Rama said, do you have Zacapa or anything close to that? And she put me onto that. So she is amazing. She
Therese,
my
she
work.
Yeah. I when she was on the show, I was like, I don't know anyone who is like a bigger cheerleader of Black chefs, Black writers.
She's
producer. Like she is a walking encyclopedia and she is consistently and always supportive.
Yeah. She and I posted this on Instagram last night because I did a talk. Last night, she came to it.
Yeah, she posted about that, and I was like, damn, I didn't know that was happening.
Yeah.
Or else I would have been there.
Yeah, and I just, like, I was thinking, like, she, like, I would do dinners. I did my Nashville dinners, which I was doing. She bought a ticket.
Mm.
She wasn't going to come. She has done that, like, two or three times. She would buy tickets to things that I'm doing around the country that she's not coming to. And then, like, I'm writing essays, and she would, like, send her a message. I'm like, can you like look at this? And she looks at this. She's like super concise in her thinking and insightful. And she just like tells me these things. And so she is just so generous. And I'm so grateful for her and her influence.
Same.
And just connecting Black folk in food together.
Same.
You know? Yeah.
And like doing it with like the context of history. Like she...
Yeah.
She knows what she's talking about. She's done the research. She, like, yeah.
Yeah, she's dope.
Say enough she's dope people. Good stuff about her.
Yeah.
So who else is there? It's your friends from.
Yeah, I have two best friends, Ife and Chuck. We are homies for life. We've known each other since we were like, we've known each other for like 12 to 15 years. We live in different parts of the country now. So I live here. I live in New Orleans. Chuck lives in Seattle. Ife lives in D.C. So we talk on the phone. We only text in three-way situations, mm-hmm. mostly. And then we have this thing called a TD. It's a tandem where we get up, we have a three-way call. So we're like, let's TD, and we do this three-way call, and then we settle. And I just want to say this, because for the record, it's like, we have been tight for a long time. Like, there was one time where our friendship was, like, tenuous when I was 22, and I went to jail. And then Ife and Chuck, like, stopped talking for a second because of that whole situation.
Because it wasn't the three of you communicating at once?
Well, because I went to jail, and, like, I think, like, because it was like a long story, but like then Chuck was like, we need to get Tunde out. And Ife was like, yo, chill the fuck out. We'll get him out tomorrow. And then Chuck was upset that they didn't get me out that same day. But they were actually like upset because something else had happened and they didn't talk for a while. And it just
were
like,
you guys all together when
we
it happened?
We're all together.
So all three of you were together and you were the one that got arrested?
Yeah, because like, I had been drinking. And then I got kicked out of the bar, and then I went into, they put me in Ife's car, but somehow I got out of the car into somebody else's car, kicked out their window. They called the police.
Where was this?
This was in Michigan. And so it was like a long thing, but the thing that I want to say is that we've been tight, right? And then and this is also serious too, is that my friend Ife is like a brilliant person. He's a doctor and he's like sheer will of his force. Like he had to become a doctor. But he's an immigrant. He's on a visa and he's like under like extreme stress. Like being black, being an immigrant, being a doctor, he has like $500,000 in student loans.
Wow.
Yeah. That, you know, that his brother had to co-sign for. But I'm getting to the point. Is that so? He was in this very stressful position with his work, with his immigration status. He was was being threatened. Like they were gonna like. He may have had to leave the country and then leave his brother with all of these loans. Ooh. His parents had to move from Nigeria to the United States, and then that was happening. And then I was in D.C. where he lives, and I'm like, yo, I'm coming through for a conference. Like, let's all hang out. And he was like, all right, cool, let's do it. And I could tell from his voice that it wasn't a good idea. But then I flew in, Chuck flew in, and we hadn't like been together in a while. And he was just so weird the entire time, just anal and just like weird. Like his energy was off. And I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Why are you like? And we went out, and it was like a catastrophe. Like literally a catastrophe. Like we were fighting. Not physically. We were arguing, mm-hmm. and then we played this game where we like hit each other or something. Like just as a game. So we were at the bar and he wasn't feeling it, and he hit me, and I tried to hit him back, but he dodged, and then I just like hit his friend, a woman, and I hit her nose with my finger by accident. That grazed her nose, and she was bleeding everywhere. And then I was like, I was like, I'm so sorry. I went with her to the bathroom and I'm like, I'm so sorry. This is terrible. And he was like, and he was mad at me. He was like, don't wait outside of the bathroom for her. You're making her uncomfortable. I'm like, I'm trying to help. And then we're arguing like, fuck you. And then I leave. And then the other friend, Chuck, was like drunk. And then we went to Jimmy John's and he throws up. yeah. Like pink. I was like, so all of that happened. And then we didn't talk to each other for like 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
You know? And it's just been like bothering me, but then like we're slowly like I don't know like putting all that together and talking, but the thing like the story there is like there's so much like emotional pressure on everybody, right? But on immigrants,
yes,
like. And this is he's like successful, like, but like this shit is like affecting his life. And we have friends who have been. A friend who like had a mental breakdown because mm-hmm. of his like an actual like he was
the
doing
stress
some
of,
he was doing some crazy, like he's fine now, but like he ran out into the fucking freeway, like that kind of shit. And we don't have ways that we deal with mental health issues in our community. I'm talking about the African Nigerian community and as men and all that shit. And so I'm just grateful for them, for all of my friends who are trying in different ways to just manage situations that are stressful. So I want to have dim sum and beer with them. That's why I told them.
And then that's it. And then that's your last meal.
That's my last meal. I can go.
That's a good way to to go, I think.
Yeah.
I think this is the longest episode of Hungry Society ever. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean that as a compliment. Yeah. It's not like a bad thing.
Yeah, of course. It can be bad.
it's not bad at all.
No, thank you for having me. This is fun. I've been drinking some whiskey from your like extensive collection right here.
That's another show's whiskey. We'll deal with that later. That's okay, though. I'm glad you had a good time.
Yeah, thank you so
much. Where can listeners find out more information about your dinners, about you? Where can people follow you?
Instagram from _Lagos, but it's sort of like oblique. Like I post random things. So I don't know. You can just, Instagram is what I'm saying.
You also have the website.
I have a website from lagos.com, but it just shows the things that I have done in a very truncated way. It doesn't say what I'm about to do, what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. So just keep your ear to...
Keep your ears peeled. Your eyes peeled, your ears open. I don't know.
Eyes peeled, ears open.
Yeah.
If we're going by, you know.
Peel your ears open with your eyes. Just do that.
Well, this has been so much fun.
Thank you.
I mean, I feel like this is the longest episode ever because, like...
I'm such a rambler.
No.
I am, but
because you talk about a lot of really interesting things and, you know, I just want to hear more and, you know...
Thank you.
All that, so...
This is great.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week on A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.